sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Biotech Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English. Imagine for a second that you had a smartwatch or an app that could customize a diet to meet your nutritional needs. It could, for example, tell you how much you need to eat and exactly what kinds of food you need based on your biomarkers like your blood pressure, your blood sugar, or even your cholesterol. And if you had something like this, you could probably better maintain your weight and avoid lifestyle diseases like type 2 diabetes and heart disease. And believe it or not, there are devices like this that are on the market and even more coming down the pipeline. One of the problems, however, is that the FDA really strictly regulates medical devices, even something as simple as this. And so a lot of these products are actually never going to hit the market, potentially. Now, my guest today is an economist and an author named Richard Williams, and he recently co-authored a new report about this technology. He's going to give us the lowdown on the situation, and he's actually going to make an argument that the FDA needs to very lightly regulate these devices. Richard was a chief social scientist at the FDA's Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition for almost 30 years, and today he is a senior affiliated scholar with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He's also written for the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Chicago Tribune. So without any further ado, here we go. All right, Richard, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thanks, Cameron. I'm great.
Excellent. So I'm really excited about this topic because I'm like many people in the U.S., I struggled with being overweight for most of my life. And it took a lot of fine tuning and a lot of just messing around to figure out what worked and what made the weight come off and, you know, help me stay healthy. And so if I had, you know, devices powered by AI or machine learning that could have customized a diet for me, I can't imagine how that would have changed my life at the time. So I'm very excited about this. But before we get into the details of what your report's about, can you summarize the problem? I mean, everyone knows that obesity and related issues are still a big deal in the United States. How severe of a problem is it?
Well, it's severe. I mean, since 1980, obesity in 1980 was about 11% of the population. Today, it's somewhere between 30 and 40%. Along with that, diabetes has increased, and of course, we're particularly concerned about childhood diabetes, which has also jumped. But just another figure, one that really jumped out at me was for teens, between 1980 and now, the rate quadrupled. And so this is a serious public health crisis. And I think the other thing, and this is more recent that's just happened, is we had heart disease going down. We've now seen it tick back up. So the concern is real.
And when I was reading the report, one thing that I guess shouldn't have surprised me, but did, is that there's just really simple problems that are impeding solutions. So one of the issues that you and your co-author bring up is the issue of nutrition labels and how unhelpful they can be, depending on the context, of course. And then you also have, surprisingly, illiteracy is a big issue. It doesn't even occur to me to think of those two things being related. But describe that situation a little bit, because that obviously is a big deal.
Well, it is. And so just to be clear, you know, I was at FDA and, you know, helped put the nutrition labels on. And at the time, we were very excited. We thought these were going to help, and we were going after saturated fat and dietary cholesterol. But we literally were, in a sense, told by Congress sort of what had to be on there. Nothing that we imagine would happen as a result of nutrition labels happen. In fact, some USDA researchers did a study and found out that the levels of saturated fat and cholesterol and total fat weren't affected at all by food labeling. And it's not surprising. It's not just the fact that we have, you know, close to a third of the country being illiterate or marginally literate. It's the fact that these things are complex. Nobody knows how to use percent daily values. And in one great research survey I saw, somebody said, trying to figure out what to eat is harder than doing your own taxes. So it is difficult. You've got USDA's MyPlate, which almost nobody uses. And then we've got, they're meeting right now, of course, the Dietary Guidelines Committee. And again, some people read these, but very few people actually pay attention to these. It's all too complicated. And in point of fact, it's not your job to understand nutrition. People have other jobs.
Yeah, I'll vouch for that. I have a wife and a dog and a career, and it's really hard. I mean, even working in science journalism as I do, it takes a lot of of work to understand all this stuff. And so I couldn't imagine if I was, you know, running a grocery store, working at a bank, and then I had to go home in the evening and try to figure out, you know, okay, how many carbohydrates do I need today in order to meet my nutritional needs? You know, it's really hard to do. One other thing that you guys mentioned in the report, I mean, you mentioned a lot of stuff, but one thing that caught my attention was that the understanding that experts have of nutrition and what constitutes a good diet changes pretty frequently. So, you know, back in the 80s, and you alluded to this already, the idea was that you needed to cut saturated fat out of your diet. And then over time, as far as I can tell from the literature, that's starting to change a little bit. You have people coming out after doing studies and saying, well, maybe saturated fat isn't the villain we thought it was, or, you know, maybe sugar's bad, maybe sugar's not bad, maybe you should eat eggs, maybe you shouldn't. Like, it tends to undulate a little bit. How big of a problem is that to the average consumer who's trying to follow what's going on here?
Well, it's gigantic. And of course, it's not just experts. You know, you got TV personalities constantly coming out with the latest fad diets, and some of them are downright scary. But it's experts as well. There's something that most people don't know about. So I'd say 80 to 90% of our research is based on trying to figure out what people eat by asking them. So we have what's called 24-hour recall data, where you ask people to record, how much did you eat? And what kind of foods did you eat? And this goes in to a survey called NHANES. So there's been some research done on that, and the research shows that about 60% of the people that answer those questions don't report eating enough food to stay alive. What's that mean? It means you've got bad data going in, and then we have all this research for diet disease relationships with this beginning bad data, and people try to fudge it and sort of make up, well, what they really meant was. And so part of the problem is a lot of our diet disease studies based on this data, we have no idea if they're right or not. And so there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty about that data.
I'm glad you brought that up, because for some research I did for an article a while back, I went and looked up these food frequency questionnaires that you're talking about. And they're really ridiculous. I mean, they're not too hard to understand, but the human mind, fallible as it is not going to know, like, okay, 3 days ago, did I have one bagel or two? You know, how many ounces of cornflakes did I have? I mean, it's silly. And I'm not complaining to anybody. I mean, it's really hard to track what people eat unless you know, put them in a hospital ward and just feed them exactly what they're supposed to have. And so this is a really big deal. And so the solutions you're talking about to this obesity issue and helping people better track their nutrition are centered around artificial intelligence. And so give us sort of a bird's eye view of how this technology could impact our health and nutrition decisions.
So if I can, let me just tell you a little bit about what's out there now.
Go for it.
For example, there's a company, it was started by Campbell's. Campbell's sold it off. But it's called Habit, and I actually did this. And what you do is you drink this really high fat shake. You prick your finger several times, and you send them blood samples. And their advertisement says, "Well, your body knows what it needs. Now you can too." And what it does is it analyzes your exercise and your personal information to give you some idea of what you should be eating. I found out, for example, that I can eat a lot of carbs without too much trouble, but I don't do so well with saturated fat. And then on the monitoring side of things, and everybody knows this, we've got now smartwatches that'll track your calories, you know, track your exercise. But we also have things like personal EKGs. We've got wireless blood pressure monitors. And coming very soon, there's going to be smart toilets that will help to analyze what you've eaten. But there's a lot of firms out there, and they're ready. They understand how much people are spending on diets. You know, they understand this crisis. And what they want to do is start putting all of this tracking data and your genetic data, what you like, you know, what your genetics are, what your exercises, what you eat, put all of that together, and then try to come up with a way to tell you what you should be eating based on your own personal characteristics. So that would be great if we had that. And what if you didn't have to use try to use the ridiculously hard to understand food label anymore? What if you didn't have to track your macronutrients and calories and so forth? What if it was just all done for you, and not just done for you, but done for you? So not a population-based recommendation, but a recommendation just for you. That would be amazing.
And there's a few other cool examples that you guys mentioned. I mean, there's, I think it was a hypothetical, but you said there, you know, there could be an individual who is disposed to diabetes, probably because of genetics, and any, you know, he or she has no idea. And so there could be a device that goes, hey, FYI, you know, maybe cut off the Snickers bars because, you know, your blood sugar is getting out of control. So is that, does that exist yet? Or is that something that you guys see coming down the pipeline?
Well, actually, we use that example to talk about what was wrong with the 21st Century Cures Act. This was a bill passed in 2016, and it was intended to help get past the 50-year-old Medical Device Act, which is what FDA is still currently operating under, to maybe get these things onto the market sooner. So here was the problem with that. They tried to say, well, look, on some of these things, can we just make them exempt from, you know, having to spend, you know, $26 million and wait a year on every single little improvement to their device. That was the idea. But here's what the exemption said. If the device doesn't diagnose, if it doesn't cure, if it doesn't mitigate, if it doesn't prevent or treat a disease or a condition, then it's exempt. Well, so the whole idea with, I think we call them Jack, if you're pre-diabetic, you would want this device, in case your doctor hadn't done it, to tell you you're pre-diabetic. If you're a company, you wouldn't want to do that because then it would put you into a higher burden FDA review. So that was the problem, that the way the law read, it didn't really help at all. It still meant that FDA has to go through, that the manufacturers have to go through these onerous reviews. And so that was the idea behind using that example. We didn't think the 2016 law really went far enough in terms of helping to move these things onto the market. And the reason that, as we began, the reason we did that is this is a public health crisis. And I don't think we can simply say, well, let's just stick with the 50-year-old law.
And that's an interesting point. And you remind me of a conversation I had with another FDA scientist named Henry Miller a few months ago on this podcast. I'm sure you know who he is. And okay, so for people who don't know, he ran the Office of Biotechnology at the FDA for a while, and he oversaw the introduction of Humulin, which was the first genetically engineered insulin product. And he told me that when that product was submitted to the agency, He and his team had it reviewed in about 4 months, and they're like, okay, this is good to go. Let's make this happen. And his supervisor said, are you crazy? If this thing goes wrong, you know, we're going to get in all kinds of trouble. And he said that mindset, that sort of bureaucratic approach to medicine really drove him nuts. Because as you mentioned earlier, you have a demand for a product or a service, you have the market providing it, but then you have regulators going, well, you know, not yet, you know? and so tell me, and you started to already, but tell me a little bit more about what an issue that is, having this agency that more or less has veto authority over what consumers have access to and what companies are going to develop.
Well, you know, FDA is our oldest public health agency. And one writer, I think back in 2010, said they are the most, in the 20th century, they are the most powerful public health agency in the world. And a friend of mine that I used to work with called FDA's role in particularly health as sort of a spoken wheel kind of thing, that they're always in the center, right? Everything has to come to FDA. FDA has this tremendous amount of power. Most people are afraid to criticize them. And that's certainly played out in the drug field, which Henry talked about, and it's certainly in the medical device field. So even in these things now, we have artificial intelligence, which frightens some people, understandably. And, you know, there's lots of fiction around about it. But the whole idea between artificial intelligence in these devices is we would have population data. In other words, we'd have lots of people recording all these things. We'd be able, if we had better monitoring of what people eat and how much exercise they're doing, we'd understand what the diet-disease relationships are, not for the population, but for individuals and subsets of individuals. That's the whole idea. And then they would improve constantly as they got more information. Well, there are some people out there, particularly I think in the legal field, who have written about this and said, oh my golly, this is scary. What we really need is for every one of these devices to go through what FDA calls pre-market approval. And when you do that, like for a drug, for example, you're talking about billions of dollars, many years delay. That would absolutely slow this market down to a standstill if we do that. And so we're going the other way. We're saying this is just not the way to go. This is too serious a crisis to have that sort of 50-year-old approach to things.
And you anticipated me a little bit. So we have a number of scholars and commentators saying we actually need more FDA oversight. We don't need less. I mean, you know, we have, and maybe there's certain people that have more trust in regulators than other people. I'm not sure, you know, what to make of exactly why people think what they do. But what do you say to those criticisms? And I know you address some of them in the paper you guys wrote. So someone comes to you and says, look, you know, we need to streamline the process, yada, 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 but we still need the FDA really playing a major role in this. What do you say to someone like that?
It is true that if FDA allows a drug or a device on the market and something goes wrong, that's the one thing that wakes Congress up. It wakes the newspapers up and they go, oh, look, FDA let this on the market. This is terrible. On the other hand, if they keep something off the market that would save millions of lives, nobody knows and nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about the way, and FDA is very concerned about their image and publicity and, you know, the money they get from Congress, it makes sense for them to be like that. It doesn't make sense for patients. It doesn't make sense for consumers for them to be like that. Unfortunately, that's the kind of pressure they get put under. So what we would say to them is we think we have a better way. And that way is, let's find a way to put doctors and people in charge of their own health and particularly what they eat. And the way to do that is to take advantage of something FDA started last year, actually. They started a small program where they're going to start approving biomarkers. And what a biomarker is like your blood pressure, right? It tells you if something more serious is going wrong. Okay. If you have high blood pressure, it tells you you might have a heart attack. That's something you want to take care of. And there are literally thousands of potential biomarkers. There's a lot of them that people have developed. They haven't been validated. That's something that FDA could do, validate and approve biomarkers. That would be something to be really helpful, particularly biomarkers for some of these diets. If we had that, then consumers could get these diets and they could see, look at a set of biomarkers and go, hey, you know what? This is really working for me. And perhaps they could go see their doctor and say, hey, here's what's happening. What do you think? And the doctor would say, yeah, it's working or it's not working. If it's not working, let's stop using that product. And perhaps they could report that to FDA. This isn't working. So it'd be sort of an ex post thing, ex ante, where FDA approves beforehand, you know, these biomarkers, but ex post, after they get out in the market, if they're not working, let's pull them off the market. I have no problem with that. But that's a lot better than saying every single device, every single improvement has to be pre-approved by FDA. And I think that's a better way to go, is to let people make their decisions based on whether or not it's working for them. There's no way FDA, with personalized medicine and personalized diets, or precision diets, whatever you want to call them, there's no way they're going to be able to monitor all that over several hundred million people.
You know, I've heard from other academics in different fields, particularly in agricultural biotechnology, because we deal with that a lot at the Genetic Literacy Project. And I've heard that complaint that, you know, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act is from 1936, I want to say. And so
originally it's from 1906.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you learned something new.
You're talking about the update in 1938. Yes.
Okay. All right. So, but the point being, we have these really revolutionary technologies. I mean, we're making very specific edits to the genome of the animals that we raise for food. And the FDA is dragging their feet and going, well, you know, I mean, we've got this 80-year-old law and we're just not sure about this. You know, we're going to regulate it as a drug. And I know geneticists who are pulling their hair out going, are you kidding me? You know? And so some of them are packing up and leaving the country. So I get the sense that this is a real issue just with the way the agency is designed. It's not any one person's fault. And, you know, I'm not trying to get political in any sense, but would you say that's the case? That's just the agency, the way it's structured right now, is a bit outdated?
Yeah, it's. I definitely think that FDA needs a major overhaul. You know, there's been two major laws in the areas I'm most concerned with. Certainly, the Food Safety Modernization Act in 2010, and then this one in 2016, which would affect medical devices and drugs. But neither one of them really changed that much about the way FDA needs to act. And with technology going as fast as it is, FDA, and even the former commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, noted this. He noted it in several speeches. They're just not in a position to help these things move along. And one of the things that I certainly think is, suppose that we had the kind of growth that we've seen in computers and computer apps and devices. Suppose we've seen that kind of growth in the medical field. Suppose that our devices and our drugs were growing at that same level, that same speed, we would probably not be talking so much about who pays for healthcare, because we would be creating much better devices, much better drugs, have much better health for everybody, and it'd be cheaper. The problem is FDA and these old laws are standing in the way of that.
So would the appropriate way to regulate these sort of devices, would they be prescription-based? Would you have to go to your doctor and say, hey, I heard about this cool new thing that could help me track my blood pressure. You know, can I get a prescription, or would it just be an over-the-counter kind of thing? How would it work in your vision of things?
In my view, they would be over-the-counter. The one thing that I could see, and we haven't really, we're thinking about getting this to a future papers, you might want to at least register it with the FDA and say, this is what we're doing. But not give FDA a yes or no over that. One of the things that FDA is trying to do, which I do have a problem with, is they have a pilot program right now where they're saying, okay, well, maybe we'll approve every device, maybe not. But what we want to do is we want to approve the firms. To me, that is a very dangerous thing for the federal government to be in, to say, yes, this firm is good, no, that firm is not. I don't think FDA is ever going to be or any government agency should be in a position to say yes to a firm or no to a firm. That strikes me as setting up a real problem, particularly, and I'm sort of a public choice economist with rent seeking. I don't want to put FDA in that position.
Sure. No, just so I'm clear. So what you're saying is the FDA would have authority to say, well, this company really shouldn't even exist because we don't think what they're doing is in the public interest. Is it that extreme?
Well, it's more like we don't think this company has the skills. We don't think they have the necessary personnel. We don't think they have whatever in order to produce a good device. So, for example, the company has to have a track record in developing and testing and maintaining software products. They have to have, this is FDA's word, a culture of quality and organizational excellence. I just can't see a government agency with many people who have never been in the private sector making that judgment. I just don't think that is the right way to go.
Wow, that's fascinating. And it was funny because I was going to ask you more about how regulation can incentivize or disincentivize development of technology. And I think you just answered my question, which is, well, they'll just say yes or no, which is,
you know, let's suppose there's a company out there that doesn't like the way FDA is regulating. The last thing they're ever going to do if they need this approval is say anything negative about FDA. I mean, that doesn't happen now, but it'd be worse then if FDA had this sort of up or down thing. And a point of fact, it kind of works that way in drugs, pretty much drugs and devices anyway. If you go in there with your drug, you know you need capital and you need ongoing capital to keep that drug going. But anytime FDA looks like they're going to slow your product down, whether it's right or it's wrong, you're dead in the water. And some of the earlier research I did on medical devices, what we found out was that a lot of medical devices would be created by physicians. They're the people who use these things and they come up with these ideas. But the moment they see what they have to go through in order to get them approved, a lot of them stop right there.
And so it just ends, like the R&D process doesn't even move forward.
It's not worth it. They don't want to go out and have to try to raise a bunch of venture capital, you know, maybe go a year, 2 years, 3 years until the thing gets approved. It's just not worth it.
So has anyone, this is probably a really difficult question to answer, but has anybody in academia tried to figure out how many things have been kept off the market or how many things were really never developed because of the kind of regulatory regime we have in place right now?
They have, you know, they've done it for drugs. I don't know so much for devices, but they've done it for drugs, but it hasn't, it's very difficult to know, you know, what would have happened, right? Certainly, for drugs, for example, one of the things that is happening is people are going back and they're looking at old drug trials. If you think about a clinical trial, it's a, in a sense, it's a population-based thing. You don't have a population, it's all volunteers, but you're trying to get a drug that improves, say, over 50% of the people that would take it, right? But what we're now beginning to realize with personalized medicine is that suppose it only worked for 20% of the people. Well, right now you'd say, okay, can't go on the market. But if you knew why it worked for those 20 people and why it didn't work for the other 80%, then you would know, well, we should approve this drug for the people that are like the 20% that it worked. So that would be an incredible change. And that's something I think that we're going to see is coming.
Oh, that's very exciting then. So, I mean, there are at least movements. I mean, you're a big voice in this, but you can't be the only person, I imagine, who's saying that things need to change. Would you say that there are more people in your field starting to wake up and say, hey, we need to adjust the way things are working here?
There are a lot of people that realize that this has to change. I don't think, and I don't know, I don't want to say that I know everything that's going on. I try to monitor as much as I can. But what I don't hear is people saying, we've really got to take a hard look at this agency that we created over 100 years ago and that has been gaining more and more power over our lives through our health and more getting fixed in what they do and only making little marginal changes. But half the time, the changes are all FDA regulates more and more stringently. It's time we take a hard look and go, is this really what we need, given that we're right here in the 21st century when things are starting to explode?
Yeah, certainly. So as we wrap up here, tell us a little bit more about yourself and your background. So I know you were at FDA, but I went to your website to prep for this interview, and the first thing I read on your bio was, Richard is a bad bureaucrat. So I'm wondering if you explain your background and really what motivated you to do this.
So I did work for FDA, for the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, for 27 years. I was an economist, and I was in charge of social sciences, like consumer studies and epidemiology. And then after I left that, I went to Mercatus, where I was vice president for policy for 9 years. And actually, even just as I was leaving FDA, after a while, when I realized that we were making no progress in food safety, and no progress in nutrition. In fact, it was getting worse in nutrition and food safety. We made zero progress all those years. I thought, my God, have I wasted my life here doing this? But it began to occur to me there were things that we could do, and we can talk about food safety and generally nutrition in another time. But I thought, I've got to start writing this down. So I have been working on a book, and it's really about how FDA sort of puts them in front of consumers, particularly FDA's welfare. What's good for FDA, it puts it in front of what's good for consumers, and how Americans can actually do better. What can we do for ourselves, and what can we do to fix the FDA? So I have an agent who is currently working to get this book to a publisher.
All right, so more to come from our friend Richard Williams. Where can people find out more about your work? I know you have a website. Why don't you give us a plug for where people can find out more about you?
Sure, just go to richardawilliams.com. And if you want to know more about what I'm doing in real time, there's a place where you can sign up, and I'll be happy to keep you involved.
Excellent. Hey, well, Richard, thank you for joining us and giving us an update on this. Pretty fascinating stuff.
All right, Cameron. Well, great to talk to you.
All right, everyone, that's going to do it for us this time on Biotech Facts and Fallacies. If you want to subscribe to the podcast, we're on Spotify and iTunes. And you can also learn more at geneticliteracyproject.org. We'll see you next time.